If you like nerds, raise your hand. If you don't, raise your standards. Today's episode, like vertebrate lungs, comes to you in two parts. The first is a celebration of the joy of finding people who share your love of something, no matter how unusual it is. And the second is a celebration of the joy I've found with people who love science in particular. So grab your pocket protectors and push your glasses up your nose. You're listening to I Heart This. I'm Ben Lord. Let's talk about what we love. Some years ago, a student emailed me a YouTube link. Hey, Mr. Lord, have you seen this yet? Looks like the type of thing you would like. The video was a parody performance of Ed Sheeran's song Shape of You, except the title of the parody was The Molecular Shape of You, and instead of telling Ed Sheeran's story of a first date at an all-you-can-eat buffet, the parody told how atoms combine into molecules, which combine into crazy complicated molecules, which combine into your body. The lyrics were witty, the animations were spot on, and the music was the painstaking mixing of one person's voice singing every musical element a cappella. The person was Tim Blay, and man, did he know what he was doing. My foot started tapping, and my head started bobbing, and I immediately wanted Laura to come listen, but she was in the shower. By the time she got out, I had discovered that Tim Blay had a whole channel of this stuff called Acapella Science, and had watched two more videos and was about to start a fourth. This one was a parody of the song More Than Words by Extreme, except this one was about the evolutionary descendants of the dinosaurs called More Than Birds. By this point, I didn't just want to show Laura some clever diversion I'd found on the internet. This was not some cat and cucumber video or someone's ranked list of the 10 worst 90s movies. This wasn't content. This was art. I dragged Laura from the bathroom, explaining the layers of artistry here. I mean, the music was so lovingly and earnestly sung, and the videography was meticulous, and the lyrics were surgical, doing so little damage to the parent material while telling a completely different story. A story that was lighthearted, but contained more than just humor, and the science! Ah, this guy knew it so well! This wasn't just parody, This was transcendent. This was discovery and wonder and awe. Awe? Laura asked with a raised eyebrow. She adjusted her towel. Can I get dressed now? I've wanted to write about different trappings of nerdiness since I started this podcast. I Heart The Far Side, or XKCD Comics. Maybe I should write about my wardrobe, which it basically consists of science-related t-shirts. Maybe I should write about Veritasium, or SciShow, or Physics Girl, or Minute Physics, or Eons, or Microcosmos, or just do an entire episode on all of them called I Heart Science YouTube. But none of them ever felt quite big enough, and I was never quite sure exactly what I wanted to say. Sometimes, you don't know why you like something, even when you are 100% certain that you do. So in this month's I Heart This, I finally decided to put it all together in one omnibus episode. This is I Heart Nerdiness, an exploration about what's truly wonderful about things like a t-shirt that says, "My password is the last 8 digits of pi." You're listening to I Heart This. Quick note, people expend a great deal of energy on Reddit forums to parse out exactly what a nerd is and how one might differ from, say, a geek. And I get it, pedantic is kind of a nerd specialty, but I have to say, I'm not really interested in that question. So I'm just going to call it, for the sake of this episode, a nerd is a person with enthusiasm for offbeat and eccentric things. My sandbox, my rules. You are welcome to proclaim how wrong I am about this on the subreddit of your choice. I knew I was a nerd from about the age of 4 because of the tub of plastic dinosaurs that I kept under my bed. God, I loved dinosaurs. I read my dozen or so dinosaur books to shreds, like they were almost completely held together with scotch tape. In first grade, my friend Ernesto and I sat at a cafeteria table by ourselves and had conversations that went something like this. Well, have you ever heard of Coelophysis? Yeah. Have you ever heard of Baryonyx? Uh-huh. Have you ever heard of Parasaurolophus? Do you mean Parasaurolophus? Dope! Ernesto always knew more than I did. Anyway, I didn't know why dinosaurs were so cool. When I was six, they were just cool. They were big, and some had sharp teeth, and they lived a crazy long time ago, and all we had were bones for clues, and scientists were figuring out more about them all the time. Dinosaurs continue to be an enduring love, but they were only the first of many. I spent a lot of my childhood passionately consumed by things that no one else seemed to care about. I spent most of my spare time reading the types of books that other kids would only check out of the library if they'd been assigned a report. There was my Greek mythology phase, there was the phase where I kept nature observation notebooks and caught insects and butterfly nets, there was the phase for birds and wildflowers, there was the phase where I was into ziggurats and Roman emperors and rocks. Man, I loved collecting rocks. Being a nerd in suburban Connecticut in the 1980s was not like being a nerd today. In middle school, for example, you were only supposed to be into one of six things: sports, clothes, the new kids on the block, members of the opposite sex, fancy cars, or making fun of new kids on the block. For some reason, it was especially important if your clothes had the right words on them, like Tommy Hilfiger or Gap or Limited. Stepping outside the bounds was a crime punishable by one's peers, and being the guy who, I kid you not, carried a mineral hammer and a pair of safety glasses on a school field trip just in case I spotted something interesting, well, let's just say I was definitely outside the bounds. Do y'all remember Bert from Sesame Street? That's a rhetorical question. Of course you do. He was a unibrowed, yellow, cone-headed Muppet. And he was also the perpetual straight man to his fun-loving roommate Ernie. He loved bottle caps and pigeons and collected paper clips. Bert was an over-the-top caricature because of the absurdity of what he loved. I mean, who could really be that into oatmeal? But here's the thing. Bert didn't choose what he loved. It just kind of happened. And when you love something that nobody else is into, everyone sees you as a bore. To me, Bert was a tragic character, alone in what he loved and because of what he loved. And I really felt for the guy because as far as the kids around me were concerned, I might as well have been into paperclips. Fast forward to the present day, and it's obvious that something crazy has happened. Over the course of about 30-odd years, nerds somehow became cool. Now, I have no data to support this, and I am no social historian, and I have no way of saying for sure what caused this miracle, but let me tell you, it did happen. I went to college in 1995, just a few years after the internet was born, when my obsession du jour was making Stone Age tools, and I remember surfing on Netscape. Remember Netscape? And stumbling on the webpage of a guy who made primitive spear throwers in upstate New York. And I actually leapt out of my chair in the basement computer lab. Somehow I had struck gold with my fascination for Stone Age technologies. Holy cow! Cave people were all over the internet! I was at the beginning of this incredible resurgence of interest in primitive skills knowledge. And yes, I am completely aware of the irony that it took the internet to make the Stone Age cool again. I am aware of it and I embrace it fully. Hallelujah. But it wasn't just me. All around the world, people were finding each other. By the time the 20th century turned into the 21st, it didn't matter what you were into. even if there were only 6 or 7 other people in the world who are devoted to your particular style of train spotting, you could find them. Do you build your own telescopes? So does this other kid in Boise. Do you carve bears out of tree stumps with a chainsaw? Post a gallery of your work, and who knows, you might just find love. Imagine Bert's joy when he stumbles across the web presence of James Ward, an author and paperclip collector who says that in that little twist of wire, he finds a piece of art. I am not making this up. It took 15 seconds on Google to find it. Nowadays, there are way more than 6 things you're allowed to be into. Instead, there is a pervasive new ethos of you do you. And you don't need to be with the in crowd to find a crowd of your own, however small, that understands the language of your heart. To see what I mean, consider the story of my eldest daughter, Eva, whose middle school experiences were worlds away from mine. Eva went to our village's tiny elementary school from preschool through 8th grade. So by the time she walked across the rented risers on her 8th grade move-up ceremony, she had been with the same 12 kids for her entire school career. My God, Eva loved those kids. She looked forward to seeing them every day. She joined the basketball team, not because she liked the sport or because she had any particular talent for it. I doubt she even knew all the rules, but she wanted so desperately to have an excuse to hang out with her friends. When the spring of 8th grade arrived and the end of her elementary school years loomed, Eva began to grieve the imminent breakup of that group of friends. Word trickled out that some of her classmates were applying to different private schools in the area, and others were going to transfer to the high school north of us, and so only about half of her friends would go with her to our local high school, and Eva knew that it just wouldn't be the same. It was around this time that Laura and I finally got Eva a cell phone, something that we had postponed for as long as we could. But by that spring, all but one other kid in her class had one, and Eva was starting to be noticeably left out of things, despite her and her friends' best efforts to make it work over email. When she got her phone, at first she was so excited to join the group chats. She would fill us in on the jokes that got passed back and forth and the drama that inevitably follows 8th graders around like a swarm of mosquitoes. And I think Laura and I were relieved that getting Eva a cell phone hadn't interfered with her continuing to grow to be the kind and bright-minded, curious person that she was. But a month or two later, something changed. And before I tell you about it, you should know that Eva almost never expresses frustration. Laura and I would joke that she would see the bright side to waiting in line at the DMV. But one night, Eva knocked on our bedroom door in tears, and after she'd buried her face in one of our pillows and we'd pulled out the tissues, she told us about how lonely she was feeling. She would send out invitations all the time, but seldom got them in return. She'd reach out to see if someone wanted to go with her to an event, and no one would get back to her. She felt like she was always contributing, always building people up, always looking to celebrate someone else, and she was just wishing for some love in return. Eva often posted long mini essays to the group chat with her poetic observations of the world. They were full of inspiration and wonder. They were sweet. They were heartfelt. They were a little vulnerable. And usually no one responded. Then someone would go back to passing memes. I think her friends just didn't know what to do with her earnestness. That particular night, someone had responded to her latest post of musings about how one ought to live a good life. It was probably like 3 pages long. And the response was, "Cool story, bro." Now, it might have been insensitive, but it wasn't mean. But I think it was enough for Eva to realize that that was the best she was going to get, even from these friends that she so dearly loved. What is a parent to do when your kid feels pangs of loneliness and hurt that you are powerless to soothe? That night, we just held her and ate ice cream and listened. Eva never stopped being her good-humored, effervescent, gregarious self. She still took every opportunity to hang with her peeps. But after that night, she stopped dreading the end of middle school, and one day she told me, "You know, I think I'm ready for high school. I think I'm ready for something bigger." And she was. After her second day at the high school, she came home with a part in the school's fall play and a half dozen new friends. "I love theater people," she told me, practically vibrating with joy. When I asked her what she loved about them, she said, "I don't know. I think in theater, people are just willing to be awkward all the time and not worry about it." She found friends who, quote, "were just so easy to talk to," who would take whatever philosophical musings she put out there and instead of saying, "cool story, bro," would say, "yes, and." Eva still has a big place in her heart for her middle school friends. She still makes time and space for them in her life, but watching her with her new friends, it is clear to me that she has found her own tribe. She's found her people. Her nerds just happen to be theater nerds. We all have our awkwardnesses. We all have our overly earnest exuberance about something, and what a joy and relief and miracle it is when we find someone else who can take our expression of that and say, "yes, and." It's a little bit like falling in love. Look out there at the communities that have grown up around all kinds of unbridled enthusiasm. Look through the vastness of the world online. There are so many people sharing their love for origami or terrariums or recreating 19th century fashions. It turns out that we were all nerds looking for a place to belong. And this isn't a kind of tribalism or cliquishness. Communities built on common enthusiasm don't have hazing rituals or purity tests. They have exuberant welcomes. Finding your people isn't about joining an exclusive club. It's about finding an inclusive one. One that is expressly inclusive of you. Take a moment to think about the comrades in love in your own life. Maybe you grow irises. Maybe you raise heritage goats. Maybe you watch horse ballet. It has never been easier to find other people who are into what you're into. We truly live in wonderful times. I am part of lots of nerd communities. Long-distance runners, foragers for wild edible plants, people interested in evolutionary ecology, amateur sundialing. I've even met another person who also makes artistically rendered 3D topographic maps, though hers are amazing and nothing like the ones I've made out of empty cereal boxes. But I'd like to segue from nerdishness in general to one type of nerdishness in particular, the flagship of all nerd cultures, the OG, the one that everyone associated with the word nerd. I'm talking about the nerdishness of people who love math and science. If you thought that other nerdly pursuits had found their own niche, science nerddom has reached disorienting levels of cool. Things like a cappella science are blooming everywhere. Even in popular culture, nerds are no longer the butt of the joke. Now they're heroes. I mean, we've got Tony Stark and Hermione Granger. We've got basically the entire cast of Stranger Things. They've even written a sitcom entirely about nerds in The Big Bang Theory. It wasn't long ago when the only nerds you could find on TV or at the movies were ones like Steve Urkel or George McFly or like Bert. The characters we portray are reflections of the attitudes of their times. And in the times of my childhood, the attitude seemed to be that people who were really into math and science were completely out of touch with everything else. They were out of touch with culture, and they had no idea about music or fashion or what was cool. They were out of touch with their peers and had to sit by themselves at lunch and had no chance of going to a dance or on a date. They were even out of touch with their own bodies. They were always represented as either simpering weaklings or overweight loners. They were insufferably dull. And the subtext was that the science that they loved was dull, too. I take that back. It wasn't subtext. It was straight text. "I'm not a math person" was a line in every single high school movie of the 1980s. Science and math were hard. You did them because you had to. If the director wanted to evoke a math classroom in a TV show, they didn't even bother to put real math on the blackboard. They just scrawled a bunch of unrelated symbols and meaningless equations. But it wasn't all just pointing and snickering. There was, and I think for some people there still is, this underlying conviction that science isn't just boring. Science is Kamazots. It saps the poetry and spirit out of everything it touches. It reduces living things into networks of interacting tissues, and sunsets and starlight into wavelengths on the electromagnetic spectrum, and the flight of birds into vector quantities. It reduces life into tables and numbers. As a man once told Richard Feynman, "As an artist, I can see how beautiful this flower is, but you, as a scientist, take it all apart and it becomes dull." Science takes a living, breathing, emergent world and reduces it to a machine. On behalf of my fellow nerds, I would like to say that this is wrong. Science is not separate from art and aesthetic endeavors. It is an artistic and aesthetic endeavor. I was recently interviewed by a reporter for a local newspaper about a collaborative lesson that I was teaching with an art teacher about soap. And the reporter asked me, "Why is it important for kids to have these kinds of cross-curricular experiences?" And I had to stop for a moment because it's a funny question. Teaching science and art together isn't actually all that weird. It only seems weird to us because that's how schools package knowledge to confer credits and degrees. But it's not a natural separation. As my wife says, kids don't see the difference. Science and art only stay separate if you work to keep them that way. And as John Green said in a classic Vlogbrothers video, the vast majority of us imagine ourselves as like literature people or math people, but the truth is that the massive processor known as the human brain is neither a literature organ nor a math organ. It is both and more. And another thing, science doesn't limit our appreciation of the beauty of the world. Of course, scientists can see the beauty of a flower, but they can also marvel at the beauty of the vast and complicated worlds contained within it. The scientist sees that this flower is built of millions of little boxes that are each in themselves alive. How fantastic! If you have never looked at a flower through a microscope, you are missing a whole dimension of it. It is a cellular wonderland full of strange and wonderful things. But that is nothing compared to the astonishing improbability of photosynthesis, which locally holds back entropy itself and somehow happened completely by accident in the primordial seas. Deeper still are the molecules, which cannot be resolved even with a microscope, but they are also beautiful even if we can only ever see them in our imaginations. ATP synthase is a particularly dazzling one, probably my favorite of all time. I can still remember the happy dizziness I felt when I realized that this unthinking collection of atoms spins like a wheel in a waterfall. And not only that, it captures energy by spring-loading other molecules that will go out to bathe every corner of the plant with stored sunlight. Don't tell me that learning about the stars will diminish my appreciation of them. I know that stars bend space-time itself. Or how about that your very atoms, didn't exist when the universe began? It took a star to make them. You are literally made of stars that blew up and sent the contents of their guts into space. What could be more wonderful than that? in one of my favorite XKCD comics of all time, one stick figure is complaining to another, "You know, the problem with scientists is that you take the wonder and beauty out of everything by trying to analyze it." When, from off-panel, another voice calls out, "Dude, my plasmodial slime molds have heightened pigment production. Check out that yellow color. It actually makes them zinc resistant. Amazing, huh?" And she runs in with a microscope in one hand and a palm full of yellow goo in the other. And the complainer holds her hands over her mouth. "Oh my God, it looks like dog barf." "Yeah," says the scientist. "F. Septica is nicknamed dog vomit slime mold. Cool, huh? Check out my slides." And the complainer turns back to her companion and says, "Okay, never mind. The problem with scientists is that you do see wonder and beauty in everything. Oh God, it's moving. It wants to hug you. So cute." Science doesn't diminish our appreciation of beauty. Beauty is why we do it. It is true that science often leads to practical applications. For example, we can fly. We eradicated smallpox. But most scientists don't go into research because it's practical. Mostly we're just too excited to see what happens next. Often, the practical applications aren't even obvious. Most of us aren't thinking, I wonder how we can exploit our newfound ability to detect gravitational waves. No! We're thinking, dude, we just saw two black holes collide! And I think that this is at the heart of nerddom. Whether it's based on a love of math or science or anything else, nerdiness is an aesthetic. It is a predisposition to find a certain kind of thing beautiful. And for lots of us science nerds, what is beautiful is the universe itself and the process of discovering it. What is beautiful is that the world is always stranger than we think at every turn. And because of that, we seek out art and stories and humor that makes the everyday normal world seem strange and wonderful again. For example, I have a t-shirt that says negative 273.15 degrees, and then below that are the words, "Absolute zero is the coolest." Oh my gosh, this shirt is beautiful for so many reasons. First, it is a secret handshake to all my physicist friends. I can't tell you how many times strangers have stopped me to high-five about it or to say, "My brother would love that. Can I get a picture?" It's an automatic signal of fellowship to other enthusiasts that I will happily engage with them about topics they might otherwise avoid at a party for fear of putting someone else to sleep. My t-shirt, in essence, says, "No way, let's go there! What do you think about Bose-Einstein condensates?" It celebrates the weirdness of there being a minimum temperature at all. Why is the world that way? So far as I know, there can't be a maximum temperature. How awesome that there is a minimum one. And it is playful and funny. I'm no comedian. Most of the time when I deliver the punchline, everyone is still looking at me and wondering whether I told a joke or not. But this shirt communicates a whimsy and playfulness even if my funny bone is broken. Something wonderful happens when art takes an idea that is usually uttered in the professional, reserved, and serious language of scientists and touches it to a third rail of emotion, in this case, one of laughter. But I think the emotional tone that I find most affecting is one of wonder. It is a great joy to think about all we've learned and how we learned it, but mostly we are in awe, yes, awe, of all that we do not know. There's a quote attributed to Isaac Newton, the authenticity of which I cannot verify, but whether it was ever actually uttered by the great scientists or not, its imagery captures perfectly my scientific aesthetic. I will tell the story as it came to me, as legend. In the spring of 1762, Isaac Newton sat for dinner with a friend who would soon also become his biographer, William Stukeley. Newton was 83 years old, at the end of a long and eventful life. He had made what were arguably the most influential scientific discoveries of all time. They had earned him great prestige, international fame, universal respect, even a knighthood. And when Stukeley pressed Newton to reflect on his lifetime of superhuman accomplishments, Newton responded, "I do not know what I might appear to the world, but to myself I seem to have been only like a boy playing on the seashore, and diverting myself in now and then, finding a smoother pebble or a prettier shell than ordinary, while the great ocean of truth lay all undiscovered before me. I am grateful for the few fragments of shell I've happened on my own, for the pretty ones that others have shown me, for my fellow beachcombers, whose enthusiasm for the shore is so infectious, and most of all, for the ocean, whose depths will always be a mystery." iHeart This is written, edited, and produced by me, Ben Lord. Our logo was designed by Bryony Morrow Cribbs. Our theme song is used with permission from neosounds.com. New episodes are released on the 14th of every month, or, you know, thereabouts. You can find our complete archive with transcripts of each show on our website, iHeartThisPodcast.com. I'd love to know what you thought of this episode or anything else on iHeartThis, so send your thoughts to me at ben@iHeartThisPodcast.com. And right now, iHeartThis is a one-man show, and that man is very busy. So the only marketing that happens for iHeartThis is the recommendation that you make on its behalf. So if you enjoyed this episode and would like us to help spread our positive message of gratitude, please consider telling your friends or leave a review. Thank you so much for listening. And as always, be kind, be curious, and be thankful.